He wasn't an intellectual. He wasn't a great speaker or a brilliant writer. He wasn't, as a military leader, a brilliant tactician or a strategist. But he had the capacity to make people want to follow him. And if there was a more courageous human being who ever lived, I don't know who it was. And it was the courage of his convictions. And he would not quit. Every sign was, it was over, you've lost, give up, it's not worth it. But no, he wouldn't stop. And he was the same kind of a unifying force when he became president, maybe more so. You know, it didn't just come to us out of the sky. It just, these advantages we have, this system of life and government and our freedoms, didn't just happen. Somebody had to work hard and suffer, and many of them, of course, died to make it happen. And the doubters were all around. It wasn't as if everybody was, oh, this is a wonderful thing, let's go out and fight for it. A fraction of the country was for it. A fraction of the country was willing to serve in the army. I think maybe if there's a message in Washington's life, it's that willingness to serve and not just talk about what you're going to do, but to act. It takes both. And absolute selfless service to the country in, as they said, war and peace. For no pay. Nothing in it for him. And then when he gets the ultimate power, as almost nobody could imagine, he gave it up. Willingly. Of his own choice. And this was after the war was over and he'd won. He was the conquering general. He was the hero. He could have been anything he wanted. Tsar, king, potentate, whatever. He could have made the presidency into a totally different kind of office. But he relinquished power. He said, no, I'm going back to Mount Vernon. And when George III heard that George Washington might do that, he said, if he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world. And because nobody had done that before. This was the ultimate ideal of Cincinnatus, you know, that the conquering general, the conquering hero returns to the plow. Well, when the British arrived in the lower bay of New York Harbor, and when they came up into the bay with a force of ships, it was the largest single armada ever seen in the 18th century. Largest armada ever sent forth to suppress another people in another part of the world in all of history up until then. There had never been anything like it, and they landed 32,000 troops on Staten Island, which was more than the entire population of the largest city in the colonies, which was Philadelphia. And when they came ashore at Long Island, they defeated our army. The largest battle of the Revolutionary War was fought on Long Island, and it was a disaster. And the retreat that followed was brilliant. They escaped at night from Long Island, from Brooklyn Heights, which was sort of the Dunkirk of the Revolution, a masterful demonstration of leadership on Washington's part, because an orderly retreat, even for an experienced army, is the most difficult maneuver to make. And to make it with an inexperienced army at night across the East River, which isn't a river at all but a tidal estuary, was almost beyond imagining. And again, the British woke up the next day, as they had in Boston, to discover the guns on Dorchester Heights, to discover that this army they were chasing had vanished. Now, it was brilliant and it was masterful, but you don't win wars by retreating, and that's all they did for the rest of that year was retreat. And the army kept getting smaller and smaller. By the time they were down in New Jersey, getting close to the Delaware River, the size of Washington's army was only about 5,000, and probably only 3,000 of those men were fit for duty. And here comes the British juggernaut with 25,000-30,000 men if they needed it. And that was the time that, as Thomas Paine said, that tried men's souls. And Washington managed to get across the river, and then He took stock, and people were saying, look, it's over, and we've lost. But he refused to see it that way, and so what he did, what is often what one has to do when all hope's gone, he attacked. And that's when he crossed the Delaware Christmas night and struck at Trenton and won, and then a few days later turned around and struck at Princeton and won. Now, those weren't big battles. They were engagements. But the fact that he'd won, the fact that they had defeated this foe, was of immense importance to morale all through the country. And that really was not just a turning point in the Revolution or in our history, it was a turning point in world history, because it wasn't going to be the same again after that. And that was force of character, force of something inside that man and those people around him, Nathaniel Green and Henry Knox, John Glover and others like that, and the men in the ranks, who were few, and they had no adequate clothing, and that some of them had no shoes. And men died. Men froze to death that night on the march to Trenton, just dropped dead from exposure in the army, on the march. And he held it together. It's amazing. And here was a man who too few people understand, loved interior decoration, loved architecture, loved landscape design, was an avid agriculturalist, as they called it then, who was fastidious about his clothing, his appearance. He had all kinds of human traits that are extremely interesting and revealing. Everybody says he was a fox hunter. Well, what kind of a fox hunter was he? He was the kind of fox hunter that was out there at the front, as close to the hounds as you could get, very dangerous place to be, and who would not give up. He would fox hunt for 7-8 hours until they'd got the fox. He just was that kind of a person, tenacious. Well, you know, if you're going to be in a fight, that's a good kind of leader to have. And, of course, we have always, as I suppose every nation and people have in all time, we admire that kind of leadership and courage, and particularly if it's in a cause that's just and a cause that's far beyond his own self-aggrandizement or enrichment of any kind. Well, he was the leader. He was the commander-in-chief. He was the winning general, in simplest terms. He won. Took a lot of good luck and help of the French, and it took a long time, the longest war in our history except for Vietnam. And then once we had won, he became the stabilizing factor in the divisiveness that immediately emerged between the regions, particularly North and South. And he held the country together for 8 years as president. And this isn't something that later day scholars have imposed on the material from the past. This is in what they were saying then. He is what's holding us together. He was the force of unity. And at that stage, we needed that desperately, because there were all kinds of forces outside and inside that were trying to break it up. Europe would have loved to have seen us break up. The faster the better. One of the lessons of any great creative effort is that it takes all kinds of people to make it happen. And it took all kinds of people to make the miracle of the creation of the United States of America happen. And they weren't the same. They brought different qualities, different abilities, different talent. What Washington brought was the gift of leadership, the gift of courage, leadership, character, conviction. Willpower. We will make it happen. And there's no limit to what can be accomplished with goodwill and hard work. And that's a tonic, you know, that's a powerful message, particularly for a people that are struggling just to make a start. He wasn't always successful. There's an idea that we have, I suppose it comes from people who are born athletes or born musical virtuosos or whatever, that he had to work hard to become George Washington. It wasn't easy. He suffered defeat. He made mistakes. He made blunders. He was frustrated in his ambitions again and again as a young man. He had a lot to learn. He had to go to the wilderness, which he did. I mean, that's something people don't understand. You talk about someone getting into Outward Bound, let's say. This was the most outward bound young man in Virginia in his day, when it was real wilderness and real adversity living with on the land or in the wilderness. And his resilience, physical, mental, spiritual, this guy could really take it. And yes, he does sometimes resort to self-pity in his letters. And yes, he can at times not tell the entire truth. And yes, he can let people down. And he's a human being. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Look, if they were gods, they wouldn't deserve much credit, would they? Because gods can do whatever they want. These are human beings who did what they did. That's what makes it a story, and that's what makes it an encouraging story, an inspirational story, if I may use that word. I don't believe much in ranking presidents. Are you ranking them as a human being? Are you ranking them as a politician? Are you ranking them in view of what they accomplished? There's so many criteria, so many measurements. But Washington was our greatest president. He was the one at the start. He held it together and he set the example. He was the defining model of what the president should be and do. We could not have been more fortunate. I mean, you talk about good luck. Good heavens. What he could have been, what he could have done that would have been so detrimental, so disruptive. And now Lincoln's great gift was a gift of soul, a depth of soul. And once again, he held the country together and fought a war successfully to free people from bondage. And Washington is there at the beginning. And the Revolutionary War is the most important war in our history, because that's how we came to be. Well, that's, of course, a very subjective question. It's personal. I think what he reminds us is that public service, service to the country, the willingness to serve is what makes it work. And nobody served longer at greater personal sacrifice with less monetary, material reward than George Washington. Selfless devotion to the cause of the country. And I think that's a lesson that can't be stressed too often or too much. He held the country together, held the cause together, and did so in a way that sets an example for behavior as a citizen that we can all learn from, and that his picture really should be, along with Abraham Lincoln, back in every schoolroom, as it used to be. And this isn't ancestor worship, or this isn't old-fashioned history. This is reality. This is the truth. And to be indifferent to people like Washington, to be uninterested in people like Washington, is really a form, in part, of ingratitude. We ought to be down on our knees every day thanking God that we are part of this country. And we ought to know about the people who made it possible and thank them, in effect, by showing interest in them. And their world, their time, I can't overemphasize that. The 18th century is one of the most interesting periods in all of human history. And it's full of tumult and change, just as ours is. And one other thing, I think any time we get down and we think, oh, we're living in such a dangerous, difficult, uncertain time, oh, woe is us, excuse me, we've been through far worse than we're going through now. With far greater adversity, far more imminent danger. We have suffered more. We have known darker clouds on the horizon by far than we do now, and we've come through it. And we will again. And let's draw from that example. Draw strength from history. History is a source of strength and should be. And Washington, of course, individually, as a human being, as a figure in history, as one of the protagonists of our story, is a particularly striking example of history as a source of strength. Everything seemed to the advantage of the conquering army. All was going as wished, except for one vexing problem that had been growing steadily worse for several weeks. Marauding and pillaging by redcoats and Hessians had gotten out of hand. "Scandalous behavior for British troops," wrote Major Stephen Kemble, the loyalist serving with the British Army, "and the Hessians outrageously licentious and cruel to such a degree as to threaten with death all such as dare obstruct them in their depredations." Kemble had recorded this in his diary in early November, before the capture of Fort Washington. "I shudder for New Jersey," he had written. The plenty of New Jersey, the garden of America, its broad, fertile, well-tended farms, abundant supplies of livestock, grain, hay, food put up for winter, barrels of wine and beer for the taking, were all too much to resist. On the first night his Hessian troops set foot in New Jersey, Captain Ewald wrote, "All the plantations in the vicinity were plundered, and whatever the soldiers found in the houses was declared booty." Ewald was appalled by what he saw. "On this march through New Jersey we looked upon a deplorable sight. The region is well cultivated with very attractive plantations, but all their occupants had fled, and all the houses had been or were being plundered and destroyed." The British blamed the Hessians. "The Hessians are more infamous and cruel than any," wrote Ambrose Searle after hearing reports of British plundering. The Hessians blamed the British. The Americans blamed both the British and the Hessians, as well as the New Jersey Loyalists, and the British and Hessian commanders seemed no more able to put a stop to such excesses than Washington had been. The stories, amplified as many may have been, were a searing part of a war that seemed only to grow more brutal and destructive. Accounts of houses sacked, of families robbed of all they had, became commonplace. American reports of atrocities were often propaganda, but many were also quite accurate. The Pennsylvania Journal, the Pennsylvania Evening Post, and the Freeman's Journal carried reports of the sick and elderly being abused, of rape and murder. No one was safe, according to the British officer Charles Stedman. The friend and the foe from the hand of rapine shared alike. The New Jersey Loyalists were the most villainous of all, Nathaniel Greene reported to his wife Katie. "They lead the relentless foreigners to the houses of their neighbors and strip poor women and children of everything they have to eat or wear. And after plundering them in this sort, the brutes often ravish the mothers and daughters and compel the fathers and sons to behold their brutality." "The enemy's ravages in New Jersey exceed all description," Greene would report to Governor Nicholas Cook of Rhode Island. "Many hundred women ravished." At Newark, according to the report of a congressional committee, three women, one of whom was in her 70s, another pregnant, were most horribly ravished.
Fear and outrage spread across New Jersey and beyond. Their footsteps are marked with destruction wherever they go, Green said of the enemy. What remained of Washington's army, the Shadow Army, as Green called it, was pitiful to behold. But give me leave to tell you, sir, Green would write to John Adams, that our difficulties were inconceivable to those who were not eyewitnesses to them.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome back to the program. Mike Lee, Senator from Utah, is with us. He's got a new book, a book that everybody should have on their shelf, especially if you are looking to teach your kids American history. This is Written Out of History by Mike Lee. These are all the heroes of the American Revolution that have been written out of history because it just didn't jive with what the story everybody wants to tell. Where do you want to start?
You know, my interest in writing this book, it came about in part as a result of my work on my last book called Our Lost Constitution. I told some stories about the formation of the Republic. It came out about the same time as this certain Broadway play, certain Broadway play that kind of lit a match.
Hamilton.
With some very dry tinder. Hamilton, exactly.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. I know the soundtrack well. I've listened to it over and over again. I hope to see it at some point, but have not been able to get in so far. But that kindled something in the American people. It got them excited. It made them realize there's a lot to learn from our founding generation. Yeah. And if we study our founding generation, we can discover some things about ourselves.
So what did you discover about us?
What I discovered about us is that we didn't start out exactly the way a lot of people assume we started out.
Wait, rich white people that are just interested in slavery and business?
That's the narrative. Yeah. That's the narrative, is that those were the only people. Everyone else in America was silent or silenced. Had nothing to say, no contribution to make to public discourse. And in this book, I outline the stories of a number of Americans who were neither rich nor white nor male in some cases. People who made a profound contribution to the early days of the American Republic. But their narrative, their story didn't fit with our modern narrative of what happened at the American founding.
Give me a couple of your favorite examples.
Mum Bett. Mum Bett was a slave in early America in Massachusetts. She discovered that with the Revolution and with the Massachusetts state constitution came out, guaranteed individuals with certain rights, that all men, and including women, were protected by these rights. And she fought for and won her slavery in court as a result of that. She made an early contribution to the abolition movement in America. The discussion of slavery was not something that just sort of bubbled up right around or in the immediate lead into the Civil War. This was something that was actively debated and discussed at the time of the Revolution.
And what year was this?
This was in the late 1700s. So about the time we became our own country, but long before anything close to the Civil War happened. So as a result of that, she fought for and won her freedom. She had a very significant role in an understanding in this country that we as individuals have certain rights given to us by God. But she was a black woman. She was a black woman who won her freedom. She didn't fit that narrative. She's been written out of history.
When did you find that? Was she ever prominent in history in America? Did we ever learn about her? Or has she always been written out?
There were times when she was well-known. She was relatively well-known at the time of the Revolution. And she continued to be well-known throughout the abolition effort. But over time, her memory faded because people assumed, you know, we've got a lot of rich white guys to talk about. That's all we're going to talk about.
We also have this belief that, and it's so wrong, that women didn't, you know, they didn't have the vote. That's not exactly right. You had to own property. So if you were a woman and your husband died and you had property, you got the vote. And it was more of a family kind of vote. It wasn't against a woman. It was about who's the owner of property, correct?
Yes.
And a lot of women played a very important role in the American founding.
including Mercy Otis Warren, another American who was very prominent at the time of the revolution, but who we've written out, who's been forgotten. She was well-educated. She was an author. She was constantly involved in public discourse. She had some grave concerns about what our federal government might become under the new Constitution. She was good friends with John Adams, but it became sort of a love-hate relationship. They had this back-and-forth exchange of letters over the course of many years in which she would raise concerns about the new government. And these discussions became increasingly heated. She ended up having a real voice in speaking out for freedom, speaking out about the fact that, you know, when government acts, it does so at the expense of individual liberty. We have to constrain government power. But that, too, conflicts with the modern narrative. And so what I've tried to do in assembling these stories is remember some of the comments that I received in connection with my last book on Our Lost Constitution. I've gone through and read the reviews on Amazon and elsewhere. Over and over and over again, some different themes developed. People would say in that story, these are great stories, but these are stories I've never heard. These are stories that are not discussed in civics class or in history class, even in AP or college level history classes. Some of these stories have been left out. So I've tried in this book, written out of history, to find more of those stories, more of the people who contributed to our founding.
But I tell you, you can go to George Washington University now and study history, and you don't have to take more than one semester of American history. So there's a good chance that you go to George Washington University and you're never taught about George Washington. I mean, we're leaving George Washington out of our history now.
And my guess is, Glenn, if you did study George Washington, it might not be the more noble aspects of George Washington's life that would be first discussed.
Well, he was a rich white slave owner.
He was indeed that.
Yeah.
He was indeed that. Mm-hmm. He was also many other things. You know, one of the...
Yeah, he's a guy with white privilege. We didn't establish that, but that's for sure.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you. Privilege. Yeah.
And yet, with respect to George Washington, one of my favorite things to show people in the Capitol is the portrait. One of the many paintings that hangs in the Capitol Rotunda is one of George Washington surrendering his commission to the Continental Congress after winning the Revolutionary War. It sends chills down my spine every time I see it, every time I think about it, every time I talk about it. The fact
you don't have to name him, but do you see anyone that is or could be the next George Washington?
Oh, sure. Look, I see a lot of people who have liberty in their veins, who long for liberty, who yearn for it. Anyone who yearns for liberty has the ability to be that person. And all they have to do is speak about it, do something about it, talk about, push back against the narrative that says that anything we do that's important has to be through government, and anything that we do through government that's important must be done through the federal government and never through states and localities. Push back against that narrative, and you will help restore the spirit of America's founding.
You talk about George Mason. You tell the story of George Mason as being kind of a forgotten founder. Tell the story that you have in the book.
George Mason was a remarkable human being. He was a reluctant statesman, one who was a man of business. He just wanted to live his own life without undue interference. He got involved in government. He ended up going to the Constitutional Convention. He ended up having some grave concerns with the Constitution, which he ultimately couldn't support, in part because he could see that the powers created by it would one day be abused. That's one of the things that we have to remember and one of the understandings we have to restore in this country. We talk a lot in our U.S. history courses in school about the Federalists, about the fact that those pushing the Constitution pointed out that there were all these protections in place. We don't talk as much about the Anti-Federalists, those who warned about how this government power could be abused, those who understood that based on human nature, human beings are by nature redeemable but flawed. And when they get power, they tend to abuse it unless that power is kept in check. George Mason was one who really understood that. And he fought hard to make sure that his fellow beings, his fellow patriots, would be protected. And he didn't want them being subjects.
Wasn't he against the Constitution as written? I mean, he...
Yes.
Yeah, he stood... But didn't he help write it, didn't he?
Yes. One of us, he was very concerned that unless it outlined more areas that were out of bounds for the government, and unless there were more protections like those ultimately provided through the Bill of Rights.
And those weren't included at the beginning. In fact, every state voted against them.
Those were not included at the beginning. But the Bill of Rights came about in part because of the efforts of men like George Mason, who said, we've got to constrain this government. We've got to identify a number of things that government just cannot do. Otherwise, government will do those things because people will come forward and say, look, this is important. Therefore, it must be done, and it must be done in the most efficient manner possible.
Mike, I was talking to somebody the other day, and I said, with an exception of maybe a couple, you know, like the vice president and removal of office of the president and the taxes and prohibition, pretty much everything else in there past the first 10 I feel like are covered by the first 10, and it's just Congress going, no, dummy, what part didn't you understand? Black people are men who are born to be free. Women are, you know, when we said men, we meant everybody. Men, women, we meant everybody. And so it's just kind of a reiteration of the first 10 because they're so well written.
In many respects, yes, and that's one of the things I love about the first 10 amendments is that they're written so carefully, elegantly, and with this simplicity that allows them to stand the test of time.
Right. Except for the quartering of soldiers. I mean, that's the only one.
You never know when that could come in handy.
True.
The day may come, Glenn, when you want to invoke
that. What do you think of the idea that that in some ways they have quartered soldiers in our home? Through, you know, NSA being able to listen and snoop and record everything that we have. Our government is in our home all the time.
Yes. And in that respect, I've got several chapters in my book that would interest you about that issue. James Otis, for example, would have been very concerned about that. He pushed back on the abuse of writs of assistance, which were these roving warrants, roving commissions that could be used by the king's officers to kick down doors, to go after any contraband goods pursuant to efforts to enforce laws that were themselves put in place to protect the British subjects in America from counterfeit non-British approved goods. This is not really a quartering of troops problem that you're describing. It's a Fourth Amendment problem. Mm-hmm. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, in their papers, in their homes from unreasonable intrusive searches and seizures is what protects us both in letter and in spirit from the NSA undertaking surveillance on the American people without a warrant.
It amazes me. There was a new study out that shows that I think it's 49% of conservative millennials say that freedom of speech, freedom of religion, yada, yada, it's all absolute. Except the government has to decide what speech is okay. 49% of conservatives think the government has to put limits on speech and press and everything else.
Yeah, and if you understand freedom of speech that way, what you're really saying is there is no such thing as freedom of speech. That's what freedom of speech is there for, is to say government must stay out.
Mike Lee, he'll be joining me soon on the television program at 5 o'clock, The Blaze. You don't want to miss that. Mike Lee, the author of the book, Written Out of History, The Forgotten Founders Who Fought Big Government, Written Out of History, something that should be on everybody's bookshelf. If you're trying to teach history to your kids, it's a great read, easy to read, and stories you've never heard before. Written Out of History by Mike Lee. It's available everywhere right now.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.